Explore the mystery at shrouduniversity.com.
And I'm the kind of person who, whatever I'm doing, wants to look at all the alternatives and weigh them. In this case, in spite of all of the data we took, we have very limited data in terms of trying to really understand how the image got formed. So pretty much anything we do, we look at what facts we do have, what data we do have, and we hypothesize and speculate and hopefully find directions for collecting new data or for analyzing current data to try to support or invalidate those hypotheses. So that's an interesting concept. I think I have a little trouble with the why or how they would do that with a dead body. But it's an interesting concept that somebody might be interested in exploring. And I think it plays back to what Joe said about we have to be very careful in interpreting what we see as true three-dimensionality. It may well just be something in the image formation, whether it's the sag of the cloth, although that wouldn't work on the back very well, or whatever. What we're seeing may just be an artifact of how it formed that we don't know, and we're interpreting as three-dimensionality or several other things.
Let me just add that when John and Eric would discuss the three-dimensionality, especially when we were making the first statues and everything, I happened to be there. I ended up moderating quite a few arguments between the two of them as to whether the dorsal image was actually 3D or not. And it pertains exactly to what Joe and Dee have already said. For example, there were areas on the back that would convince one or the other of them that it wasn't 3D, that there was some evidence that the body was flattened at a certain point. So you also need to be careful how you interpret whether or not the body was vertical, because I listened to the discussions back and forth, and I don't think there was a consensus as to exactly what it meant.
I just want to point out that this is a theory that's been proposed by Gil Lavoie, Dr. Gilbert Lavoie of Massachusetts. I don't believe Gil's here, but he did address it in his book. Somebody help me with the name of the book, quick. Unlocking the Secrets of the Shroud. Thank you. So that theory has been addressed. There are some objections to it. I'm not going to voice them, but there are some objections to that based on, and I wish there was somebody here a little more qualified to discuss it, or that Gil were here to discuss it, because it is his sort of proposed theory. But it has been dealt with, so if somebody is more interested in getting details about what that theory might entail, he spent some time in his book discussing that.
It is correct. We do not know what the mechanism was that made the image. So therefore, we also don't know if the body was compressed, because we wouldn't know what made the image. Was it contact? If it was contact, then if the body was flat and it was in full contact with the cloth, then the contact image would probably have characteristics that would show compression. If that wasn't the mechanism that created the image, all bets are off. If you'd like to look at a VP8 image of the dorsal, I've got one here. We can set it up. You can take a look at it yourself. Be your own judge.
I'm going to make one more point. Thank you. Make me think of something. There's been a lot of talk that there is no dimensionality or spatial or 3D or something like that on the dorsal image, and I totally disagree with that. Because there absolutely is, particularly in the legs and the thighs and the calves, are absolutely clear. And the best example that I've seen of that, sadly, doesn't come from the VP8, but it comes from the work of Aldo Goreschi, who uses a photorelief technique, which is another way of visualizing these same properties. So people who say there is no spatial information on the dorsal image, I don't know what they're looking at, but there's plenty there visible. Sadly, I believe John Jackson's one of the people that says that.
I wonder if anyone has any comment about the issue of the stereo registry difference between the blood stains that appear in the hair, but are arguably coming off the face, so that the cloth presumably may have been in two forms. One form conforming to the face when the blood was transferred, and another form when the image was transferred.
That's another thing that Gil LaVoy has done extensive work on, and I think with some real credibility.
Yeah. Well, I've seen the picture. That looked fairly convincing as far as the blood that now appears in the hair. But
yeah, and I think the voice work in that area is really pretty solid, and I think has been not challenged by very many people as something quite credible. What happened to the wireless mic? Russell, did you take that away?
Okay. Jim, I'm trying to answer all the questions.
Let me get you
on. Press the mic. Let me get you on. I'm jumping up and down.
Nobody wants to. Gil has done a lot of work on that, and very convincing, I do believe. And there are others who have done a lot of work on that. And there are several resources that you can find. I think some of them on your website, and also some things that John Jackson has done that he's contributed.
In the back.
Yes, sir. I'm not an expert in the shroud at all. I became interested in it about 5 years ago. I am interested in finding out how much money has been spent on the shroud.
Personally, or what?
Where does the money come from? I mean, who spent it and how much?
Most of us are out of pocket untold sums of money. Most of us are out of pocket untold sums of money. This is not just a hobby, it's an avocation, if you will. And before we went to Italy, the Durant's Foundation gave us hundreds of thousands. I don't remember the exact
total.
Not
what they
was. Under 1,000.
It was about 100,000.
Okay. And then we had donations of upwards of $1 million worth of
equipment. That's money from National Geographic.
Yes.
$2,500.
That's all.
Yeah.
Geographic gave us
$2,500. We had initially some donations from National Geographic and the Durant's Foundation. I think maybe, if I took a wild guess, at the onset of 1978 expedition, maybe there was $150,000 associated. Now, that doesn't include all the money that was spent. If you want to translate time into money,
yeah,
by the various people preparing for it, or all the work that's been done subsequently to that. By the way, I want to say that the appearance of logos in any of these viewgraphs doesn't necessarily suggest institutional endorsement of this. Yeah, serious trouble.
let me toss out one of the anecdotes that Joe was referring to. I think when we left, they had airfare for all of us.
Yes.
They did not have coverage for the hotel. We were all told to bring our plastic with us because we may have to pay our way out of the hotel.
That's true.
At the last minute, is the Durant Foundation the Harry Johns?
Harry Johns.
Yeah. Okay. At the last minute, they stepped in and paid the hotel bills. But this whole thing, you know, I was an agnostic at the time. I billed myself as an agnostic with my antenna up. But so many things happened to make this all come together that I tell you, it was awful hard to be an agnostic back then.
Okay, one more quick anecdote. When I was about to do this, I didn't have any money to take with me to Turin, so I went to my banker. And, of course, I'm Jewish, as most everybody knows. And I went to my banker and I said, listen, I'm going to Italy and I'm going to go examine this piece of cloth. And he looked at me and said, and I said, well, I need to borrow $1,000 because I'm broke and I don't have any money to go with it. And he looked at me and he said, what piece of cloth is this? And I said, well, it's called the Shroud of Turin. Well, he'd never heard of that. And finally, I mean, I sat there with the guy for about a half hour, and I can be reasonably convincing, remembering what my initials are. And eventually, he looked me right in the eye, and he says, well, I don't know anything about that. He says, but I'll loan you $1,000. That was the money I took with me to Italy and was never reimbursed. I just had to pay it back. So when people talk about what Stirp did, there was a lot of out-of-pockets. There was a lot of personal effort. And remember, This didn't start when we went to Italy. This started almost 2 years before we went to Italy. A lot of our time flying around to meetings, stuff like that, all that was at our own expense.
There was one other thing. Several of us started early on giving talks, and STIRP had little envelopes that you could pass out at the talks, and funds were raised through that way, because at one point, Tom DiMahalo, who was then the head of STIRP, was keeping track of who was doing the best talks financially, and I ended up kind of talking to Harry John of the Durance Corporation because he thought I was getting the most return.
I just kept mine, so I was
Yeah, I tell you, it's like most church work. I'm going to become a deacon so I can be rich.
Can I say, here's a couple of other things. I mean, my impression, just looking at the landscape, is that most of the research since has really been done by individuals sort of out of their homes or garages. I mean, I don't get a sense there's been a lot of institutional involvement by universities, corporations, churches, just individuals.
Right.
Frederick Zugby doing all these experiments, the crucifixion out of his home, and Gilbert Lavoie doing experiments out of his home. I mean, I get the sense that, you know, subsequently, it's really been a grassroots thing that's been done by committed individuals, not really endorsed by organizations at all.
I think that's a fair comment. I would say that, for example, going back to 1978, I was in the Air Force at the time, and I did it all in my own time. However, I will say that the Air Force was gracious enough to loan us the equipment.
Yep.
I had to sign my life away to take it to Italy, but there were lots of contributions like that that are very difficult to quantify.
Yeah.
So if I had to set a number to all of this since 1970, the last 30 years or so, it's probably, it's probably approaches $5 million in terms of effort, or maybe even more in terms of effort and equipment and
time.
Other forms.
I get the impression that the foreign activity is financed differently than what we're talking about in the United States.
That's possible. I don't know. Anybody want to comment on that?
Well, remember that the Shroud is in the control of the custodians of the Shroud in Turin, which is now legally owned by the church, or the living pope, it's believe the way the will of King Umberto said. So I think their resources are a lot better than a group of individuals from the United States who put their heads together to do this, and everybody thought we were crazy in the first place. So I don't know that there's ever been any substantial institutional involvement in the examination of the Shroud from our point of view.
In France, the étude is financially backed by the government.
There's some government backing there, but the best that I can say from government backing is the fact that the people who were from Los Alamos and Sandia and Air Force Weapons Lab didn't get fired. So I mean, that was sort of their...
That was good.
That was a good thing.
You know, thanks to the now notorious carbon-14 dating, it's been very difficult to do, for example, even what Joe accomplished here in this conference, to get university support and things like that. I've been working because my initial publishing contract was through people tied to Duke University. There are other people that are connected to other universities. What we really need would be that type of ongoing place of support where we could hold conferences and so forth. And some of us have been talking about just trying to establish that kind of thing, maybe with a nonprofit, maybe with a museum, etc., so that our various collections after we're gone would have a place of residency where ongoing research could happen.
I will make another comment about institutional involvement. In many cases, for example, at universities, when you achieve a certain status, or for example, at maybe even the government laboratories, they pretty well let you do what you want if you get senior enough. So there's that level of, I wouldn't call it institutional support, but it's sort of institutional, shrug your shoulders and say, well, this person is a very senior scientist and he has earned the right to do the sorts of research that he has to do. So in many cases, I would say that was the case of Ray's case.
He
was a fellow, and when you reach that status, you just do what you want to do.
Yeah.
As a matter of fact, I might say that make sure you're here tomorrow. You'll see another example of that.
Good.
Cryptic.
Okay, we've gone into the lunch period. This is so interesting. I'd rather hear this than eat personally, but
speak for yourself.
Explore the mystery at shrouduniversity.com.